Did you know in Orlando, the Halloween celebration has already begun? So don't wait. Treat yourself to an Orlando escape. From Halloween Horror Nights at Universal Orlando Resort, to Halloween Spooktacular at SeaWorld, to Mickey's Not-So-Scary Halloween Party at Walt Disney World, no one tricks and treats like Orlando, the Halloween vacation capital of the world. For official event schedules, discounted attraction tickets, and hotel deals, click to visitorlando.com.
Yo, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Source Material Comics Podcast, Onslaught. This is week two of Onslaught Week here in September on the Rattlitch and Broadcasting Network. The Source Material Podcast is doing a focus all month on the 1996 Marvel Comics event, Onslaught. Tonight, just like last week, we have the same panel. First, let me introduce the patriarch of the Rattlitch in Broadcasting Network, Mark Rattlitch. Sir, we are going into week two of the discussion on Onslaught. What do you got to say, Mark Rattlitch? Are you ready?
Let's do this thing.
All right. Good enough. And then my 90s comics enthusiast buddy from the Unspoken Decade and my co-host of the Unspoken Issues podcast, Chris Armstrong. Chris Armstrong, it's Onslaught Week 2. What you got to say about it?
I'm excited. I've done some actual research. Oh. I feel like a journalist over here.
Somebody came prepared. I am impressed.
I'm excited. Very good. And you heard him last week. Welcome back to the Source Material Podcast. Evan Bevins dropping some knowledge here last week on Onslaught. Week one, week two is here, buddy. You bring some stuff to talk about. Squirrel Girl is nowhere to be found in this volume, unfortunately. So I know you may be sad about that, but what do you got to say, Evan?
Well, I haven't figured out how to work in Squirrel Girl yet, but, you know, never say never. And I am a journalist, and I didn't do as much research as Chris did. But I did scour the back issue bins at Comic Sense here in Belpre, Ohio, and came up with Spider-Man number 72, which I never actually read the first time around. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that comes up. What was that like? I think the third to last book. I think so.
Yeah, that's one of the 36 Spider-Man. Tie-ins to this. But, I mean, before you think they go overboard, there were approximately 47 ongoing Spider-Man titles at that point in time. Mm,
true. Oh, true. Just a fair percent there.
All of what he said is true.
Every little bit of it. So, this is going to be Volume 2. If you look for this trade paperback, you'll see X-Men at the top, and then it says Onslaught, the complete epic. This is Book 2 down there in the bottom left corner. That's what we're going to be discussing tonight. So kind of where we left off last time is... And I listened to the podcast there earlier, so I may forget something. I don't know. But I know for a fact that we learned who Onslaught was. Onslaught was Professor Xavier. We got hints that Magneto may be involved, possibly. The rest of the X-Men and mutants were trying to gather forces. And we also realized that there were some people that Professor Xavier was kind of doing some research on. We're kind of worried about that because they all seem to be mutants, or at least... we'll say very powerful beings in the Marvel Universe, one of which is Franklin Richards, the son of Sue and Reed Richards, who happens to be a very powerful one. And he is a mutant, right? Am I right there? Okay. So he happens to be a very powerful mutant. Also, the future son of Jean Grey and Cyclops, actually, I shouldn't say future son. He was their son, sent to the future. This is Cable, the Nathaniel Summers. He's kind of... Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was going to... You may edit this out if it sounds jerky.
Oh, go ahead.
Technically, Cable is the son of Cyclops and Madeline Pryor.
Oh, Madeline Pryor. That's right.
If you're going to say technically, I'm going to need you to do it in a funny voice.
Technically...
Thank you.
Also, just an aside, I think X-Man, who is basically Cable from another reality, had a little romance with Madeline Pryor. So do with that what you will.
I, So the other powerful mutant is just happens to be X-Man. And it looks like Professor X has been doing some research on him as well. So that's kind of where we left things. You know, Onslaught has made his appearance, and then he kind of left with the Dark Beast in tow. So we know that there's some dirty dealings going on between those two. As yes, Beast, the Beast that everybody thought was the Beast, turns out to be the Beast from the Age of Apocalypse universe. We find out, and along with all of the X-Men find out that we had a kind of a traitor in our midst there. Not only was it Xavier turning into Onslaught, but it was also Dark Beast was doppelganging. That doesn't sound good. he was putting on a facade. He was acting like the regular Beast. But anyway, there you go. So caught everybody up. Trust me, if you just go back and listen to our first episode, we do a tremendous job discussing what happens in each of those. So
tremendous.
Tremendous. We're hopping into volume two, and I'm going to give a really quick, this is a one paragraph of what happens in all of these. So book two mainly focuses on the impact Onslaught has on the Marvel Universe. On the mutant side of things, the X-Men fly to Muir Island to learn all about the Xavier protocols, while Wolverine and Elektra learn about the main impetus of creation of the being that is called Onslaught. At the Xavier Institute, Nate Gray, or as we all know him, X-Man, and X-Force are preparing a defense for Onslaught, but find they have to try to survive an attack from Mr. Sinister instead. And X-Factor battles the Dark Beast, a Hank McCoy from an alternate reality, rescuing the real McCoy. I got that one. Got that from the book. Rescuing the real McCoy, but failed to stop the launch of many Onslaught-altered Sentinels. Now, just real quick, ladies and gentlemen, Sentinels were a human creation, I believe, that was made to police mutant affairs. Well, Onslaught got a hold of them, reversed their programming, so now they're going to be policing human affairs. Now, across New York, the presence of these giant Sentinels are everywhere, placing the city under martial law. Mainstays like Peter Parker, Ben Reilly, Punisher, and even the Green Goblin are feeling the impact of Onslaught's machinations.
I'm sure it's just a phase.
Good one. So there you go. That is what we read here in these 8 issues. It collects Excalibur 100, Wolverine 104, X-Factor 125 and 126, Sensational Spider-Man number 8, Amazing Spider-Man number 415, Green Goblin number 12, Spider-Man number 72, X-Man number 18, X-Force number 57, and Punisher number 11.
I have two questions.
All right. Yeah.
Two questions. Before we start, Evan or Chris, please answer this one question. Did there come a point where Marvel just plumb ran out of writers, and when they were trying to create characters, they were like, fuck it, we'll just turn all the villains into heroes, and we'll put 97 versions of the same character in there because we can't create anything new? Did I miss something?
I mean, I don't think they ran out of writers, but most of the rest of that sounds accurate.
Okay.
Actually, there were still a slew of original characters in the 90s, and some of them did not have guns. Everybody who appeared in X-Men in the 90s had guns, except the ones that had swords.
That sounds about right. As I was reading this, I was like, I don't know what the Clone Saga was. I don't know. All I know about this Ben somebody Spider-Man is that Ben Colon hates him. I know two things about Ben Colon. He's an artist who does his own comic book, and he hates the Ben Urich Spider-Man or whatever the hell his name is.
Ben Reilly.
Ben Reilly.
The long story short is that Amazing Spider-Man 125, he fought a clone of himself. He was like, wait a minute, am I the real one? Well, I must be, because I love Mary Jane. And then somebody was like, hey, let's bring that back. And then somebody was like, you know what would be cool is if the Spider-Man everybody had been reading for 20 years was the clone. And then everybody reading the comics was like, hey, that's a horrible idea. And so then they were like, nah, he was the real one the whole time.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, that was one of my notes, was as we get into the Spider-Man issues, there is a lot of reference to the Clone Saga. Obviously, you got to. I mean, if you're just popping into Spider-Man, Sensational Spider-Man, or something like that, and you have no idea what's going on, and you realize that there's two Spider-Man running around, you got to have an explanation. So that's got to be explained every single issue. But we'll talk about that here in a second. So, yeah, Mark, you didn't know about the Clone Saga. You probably had no idea as to... You're probably in the dark like I was with Mystique and Sabretooth as to why in the world they were on X-Factor.
That made sense. Okay. What didn't make sense was who was the guy in the Green Goblin costume and why was he helping?
Okay.
He All was right. Ben Urich's nephew, Phil. That sounds like I made it up, but I did not. And that's really all I know, except he had some sort of super-powered laugh, and he showed up a few times off and on over the years.
Yeah, this is not your Osborn Green Goblin. This is somebody who found, I think they said this in the book, that he found the mask of, was it Harry or Norman? It was Norman Osborn's mask, right? So, anyway.
Probably would have been Harry's, because Norman had been dead for like 20 years.
Okay, all right. Yeah, I remember they specifically said whose mask it was.
I don't think I should ask any more questions, because this is going to end with me walking into the woods to live deliberately.
Okay.
You going to build a treehouse like Wolverine?
It's already started.
Mark Rattles, his fingernails are growing long and toenails are growing long as we speak.
Well, that was happening before all this.
All right, well, let's talk about Excalibur 100. Excalibur 100, Onslaught Impact 1, London's Burning. Story by Warren Ellis, Casey Jones, Randy Green, and Rob Haynes. In this issue, there's a pretty crazy storyline that they are actually in the middle of, involving the Hellfire Club, supernatural artifacts, and a plot to silently control the population. But in the middle of all this, the X-Men, Jean, Psylocke, Cannonball, Cyclops, and Angel, arrive at Muir Island to talk to Moira MacTaggert about Professor X going insane and turning into Onslaught. Moira tells the team about the Xavier Protocols, which involves the plans for a psionic suit that Xavier created in case he ever turned evil. The team also discover that the Xavier Protocols were also ways to kill the X-Men as well. You know, really, just briefly, I'd say 80% of this book should not have been in here. It was filler. This would have been something that we would have seen two panels of in the first volume, but now we've decided
complete
to stick.
Complete Onslaught epic.
That's true. I mean, we can't get away from the completeness. Oh, well, you want the full issue? Here's a double size issue 100. Okay, so Warren Ellis told this whole story, but we are dropped in the middle of just a completely separate storyline, and the only thing that matters here is the fact that the X-Men show up to find out about the Xavier Protocol. So
it's like after that dramatic call that Jean Grey sent out, Excalibur's line said, "The party you have dialed is not available. Please go to Muir Island for some exposition."
Please do. Please do. So what do you think about these Xavier Protocols?
Well, the Xavier Protocols are apparently Professor X's thoughts on what to do if certain mutants go out of control, including himself and most of the X-Men. You know, it kind of shocks everybody because, I'm sure there were some times in the X-Men's history where Professor X wasn't that great a guy, but this was before revealing Professor X was a total jerkwad was, an ongoing X-Men plot device.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, in more recent years, we found out, there was that other team of X-Men he had that all died before he brought in Wolverine and everybody. And then, like, 2 weeks later, it was, and the Danger Room was a living thing that he enslaved because, hey, really good training. But back then, he was pretty much a saint, so the idea that he was coming up with ways to kill off the X-Men, while practical, I mean, he wasn't actively plotting their murders, but he was like, hey, if they go out of control, this is something, that we need to be prepared for.
It's happened in the past. They had to deal with the Dark Phoenix saga, so I'm sure that he probably was like, okay, well, this was pretty bad. I better get prepared, a little more prepared. And not only did he get... I mean, the first thing we see is the psionic suit that he is supposedly devised and talks about, okay, here's what needs to happen if I'm the bad guy. But then we got, okay, here's what needs to happen once Wolverine's the bad guy. It goes into detail about how, they could kill him because he doesn't have any adamantium bones anymore. It's kind of shocking for the team to kind of deal with that. But
yeah, that was the one thing that really stood out, because when I was reading this issue, I was like, I remember this cover, but I don't think I ever read this issue as I was going through. And then I got to this explanation of how to kill Wolverine. And I was like, I have read this because I remember this specifically.
Oh, yeah.
Because he points out, quote, "His head would have to be severed and removed utterly from the vicinity of his body to prevent swift flesh and nerve regrowth." So you have to decapitate him and throw his head as far away from his body as you can get it.
Yeah, yeah.
I just say that, I mean, I don't know that you really need Professor X, this brilliant guy, to come up with that. I mean, it seems kind of obvious. You know, like, I don't know if they had others in there, like Gambit. Well, watch out for the playing cards and then just shoot him.
The other thing is, like, at first, it's really cool from a story standpoint. You know, it's like, oh, well, if Moira, Scott, and Jean are here, I must have gone bad.
Yeah, you know, I didn't understand that. And then Angel walks in and everything changes. Like, oh, okay, yeah. Now it's Wolverine.
Yeah, it's like, these are the guys who would come if it's like, well, what if Wolverine stabbed Cyclops? You know, then it's like, Professor, how do we kill Wolverine? You're going to need Cyclops. Well, he's in pieces. I mean, like, you know, from a storytelling standpoint, it's cool. It's like this thing, like Xavier's predicting all this stuff. And I don't want to bash people's ideas, but it's like, you know, suppose that, Cyclops was in the can when they unlocked that protocol.
True.
And, you know, what if Jubilee walked in and it's like, oh, well, this is what happens if the Blob has diarrhea. You know, I mean,
yeah,
it probably only needed to be done once. Like, I'm with Evan on that one. I like the Xavier protocols, but the whole idea, but I feel like it should have been those three that unlocked all of them, not a different set of brain scans that unlock different things. Because you're right. Just like, okay, well, if Wild Child, X-Man, and Toad walk in here, what happens? Like, now we're just trying different combinations.
That's
of
how we stop Avalanche.
Yeah.
The villain, not the, actual disaster.
So Cable, yeah, Cable was the third one. I knew there was a third one that they brought up in the Xavier protocols. So about that time, Moore's like, okay, that's it. We don't need all this shit. We just need to know about Xavier. Thank you very much. So yeah, and one of the things that she says is like, you know, he's been figuring out ways. Xavier's been figuring out ways to murder them since the beginning.
They're taking it as a betrayal, but the reality is at least one of the X-Men has tried to murder everybody.
True.
So I would imagine that even if he didn't have this plan from the get-go, I would imagine after the Dark Phoenix saga, Xavier's like, well, fucking never again. And then he thought, you know, and then he had the foresight, which I like to say, okay, you know, if she can go bad, I'm sure some weird shit can happen to me too, and I'll go bad. Mm-hmm. And if that happens, they're going to need to know how to defeat a guy who can control minds and, you know, mind wipe people and do all kinds of terrible things. So to me, you know, as Evan said, from a story standpoint, it made sense. I think my only issue with it is that it kind of takes away one of the things about being a hero, which is figuring out how to defeat the bad guy. He just kind of hands over, you know, he just kind of hands them a magic gun. Says, here, make this, and you know, you'll if you need it, you'll defeat me.
I have my doubts, though. I can't remember how this ends, but I have my doubts that that's just going to work. I really don't. I mean, I think it's going to help at some point, but I don't even know if it's going to work. So
I can't remember if that armor ever shows up. I mean, I guess it'd be in volume 3 or 4, but I can't even remember. Actually, it looks like stuff I've seen Professor X wear. Huh. So maybe that's the big reveal. It's like, haha, I just made you guys make my favorite suit.
And I'm going to end the world in style. All right. Well, any other notes on Excalibur 100? I mean, what was the name of the side story that was going on?
The Devil Under London. No, yeah. Onslaught was the side story.
Oh, that's true. Excuse me.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a decent excuse, I guess, for not bringing Excalibur in. I just always thought it was weird. Like, Kitty Pryde and Nightcrawler are two of the people you think of as, like, you know, stalwart X-Men, and Excalibur ran for, I think, 125 issues, and they were over in Britain. They were missing for this huge chunk of X-Men history, except, you know, for the big crossovers, mm-hmm. where they could, you know, stand in the background or completely ignore everything that was going on.
I was going to ask, like, when did Excalibur stop being the funny X-Men book? Because that's when me and my dad were collecting it.
Yeah.
And we found those first, like, that first run of Excalibur where they were a bunch of silly pantses to be really entertaining. And then I'm reading this and I'm like, what happened to my Excalibur? Well, these guys are too serious.
I don't know. How long was Warren Ellis on the book?
I don't think he had been on very long. I'm trying to, because I would drop in and out of Excalibur. I mean, it went into at least the 50s issue numbers before it got more serious. But I am not sure. Somewhere between issue 55 and 100.
Okay. Excalibur's 83 through 90 is volume one. That's Warren Ellis Excalibur Visionary. So I don't know. It
didn't go much past 82.
Yeah. And if you collected it since the beginning, Mark, that's probably right. I mean, Warren Ellis he's a pretty popular comic book writer. I can't name any stories off the top of my head that he's done.
Because nothing can have any levity in it. Got it. Especially in the 90s.
You said Transmet?
Transmetropolitan is one he's really known for. I mean, he's never been one, like, to my taste personally. I mean, he's really well thought of, but I think his humor is a little darker. I know he's done a lot of Wildstorm stuff. I can't remember if it's The Authority or what kind of
Wildcats.
Probably did some Wildcats.
He just did the Wildstorm book that DC's been publishing recently, and there's a new Wildcats that he's supposed to be writing. It was supposed to come out like in any time, and then they canceled it like a month ago, so it basically got pushed back. But yeah, he did the Planetary, which is one of my favorite comics.
I remember it being pretty decent.
He's really hit or miss. I've read a lot of comics of his that I thought were really good, and then a lot that I'm not a big fan of.
But. All right, well, let's move on, unless anybody else has anything on Excalibur 100. We're going into Wolverine 104. This is a script by Larry Hama, by the way. Wolverine number 104, Onslaught Impact 1, Emperor of the Realm of Grief. Story by Larry Hama, Val Semeeks, and Chad Hunt. Wolverine has been sent to ask Gateway about his knowledge of Onslaught. Problem is, Gateway is an aboriginal teleporter / mystic that doesn't speak. Elektra shows up, and we learn she has been helping Wolverine try to become more human again since his feral transition of late. As Gateway shows them horrors from both Elektra and Wolverine's past, they see the battle unfold between Xavier and Magneto on the astral plane. These were events that occurred in Fatal Attraction. As things are slowed down and peeled back, the two see Magneto's evil astral ego reach out and plant a seed of influence in Xavier during the assault. Yeah, Mark and Evan, you both said, I think both of you said that you enjoyed the Elektra Wolverine arc here. Mark, I'll let you speak on it here.
I was getting a little sick of like animal living in a treehouse Wolverine, so I like that. Interesting guy, though, to send on a mission to go get, you know, plot exposition from this Buddhist, I guess, fella.
Oh, the aboriginal, you're talking about Gateway.
Yeah. You know, it's like here, we need somebody who can really elicit conversation, get information, and is really patient. Send the guy devolving into an animal. All right.
I think it's that he has a connection with Gateway from back when the X-Men were in Australia. I think they have everybody who's terribly mysterious and doesn't talk much apparently had a beer with Wolverine at one point. So.
I understand. But I liked it because it made Wolverine a character instead of what he had been in the first Onslaught book, which I wasn't crazy about. Wolverine kind of coming to terms with the guilt over his part in Xavier losing his mind, because the way that he spells it out is that he went crazy, drove Magneto to rip out his adamantium, which then set Charles off, and Charles mind wiped Magneto. And he's like, if I hadn't let myself do the exact thing that Charles has taught me not to do, none of this might ever have happened. Mm-hmm. And him trying to wrestle with that guilt. There's all kinds of arguments. I mean, you know, even Elektra says to him at the time, like, it really is not your fault, though. You have no, you don't know how Magneto would have reacted. Quite frankly, I don't understand why it took all this time for Magneto to come up with that. But fight one should have been yoink. Out comes your adamantium. But whatever. I don't write comics. But also, you know, Elektra, you know, with her storied past, I like that she was kind of like a sympathetic ear to Wolverine, and that she was sort of balancing him out. I don't need every page in every comic to be a lot of fighting, you know, the punchy parts, as they say in Doom Patrol. I like that this was a psychological, emotional struggle for Wolverine, and to a lesser degree, Elektra. I thought that was all good stuff.
Yeah, Chris, I had you written down here, man. You had a something to do with Onslaught's origin and Wade Lobdell conflict. So whichever one you want to go with first.
You know, it gets revealed here, something that's been hinted at already in previous issues, that, you know, Xavier is Onslaught But they explain here that the impetus between in him turning evil essentially was a piece of Magneto when he did the Magneto mind wipe, kind of latched on to his psyche, and that's kind of what's turned Xavier into Onslaught.
Yeah, hence, so that little seed of evil or ego or whatever Parallax they say.
Style.
Exactly.
Which Geoff Johns, I guess, kind of, I don't know that he swiped this, 10 years later, but it's pretty similar to what he did with Hal Jordan and Parallax.
Well, now that you mention that, did they, am I imagining this, or was there not a debate over whether or not this was in Charles all along that, yes, this like parasitic thing jumped out of Magneto into Xavier, but I think there was also this argument of there was always something in there, it just took all of this for it to come out.
I, on our last episode, I remember us talking about how, in one of the panels that showed Xavier and Evan actually has a toy, an action figure that has Xavier in the back of...
Yeah, not a toy, Jesse.
Sorry, my bad.
Collectible. It's sitting right beside my computer.
My bad. But yeah, Xavier was inside of Onslaught, so we were kind of thinking that they're two separate beings. But what brought on that argument, that debate as well, was that, okay, you said that you liked it better that Onslaught was born of all the strife that was in Charles Xavier. But what we think here's the way I take it. I think that little bit of evil ego from Magneto got into Charles Xavier's psyche, and then it was that... it was that TNT or that gunpowder to start the explosion. So I'm sure that it took a combination of both.
Because I was gonna say I'm okay with it being both. I'm not okay with it just being he'd have been eating apple pie and good to his mother and voting Republican had he just not been bitten by a parasite from Magneto. That's ridiculous.
I'll agree with that.
I think it was kind of in there as a bit of a get out of jail free card, like a way to go to eventually restore the status quo, as much as it's like, oh, nothing will ever be the same again. But exactly like Chris mentioned with Parallax, it was, oh, Hal didn't do all that stuff. It was a yellow bug.
That's right. Yeah, we talked about broken characters on here before. Things where heroes go cross that line. And, when Hal Jordan was breaking necks of Green Lanterns and ripping off hands and fingers and rings, you're like... Pat Mullen ripped the comic in half.
he's a little emotional.
He got upset. So there was, there's that point where can you bring a character back? So you're right. I think that's exactly what it was. It's just kind of, hold on a second.
So we're in agreement that it's a little bit of both, but especially because they want to have an out to say, no, Professor Xavier's a saint.
I'll agree.
The reason I wanted to bring it up specifically is I remember reading interviews with, Mark Waid, co-wrote the X-Men Onslaught, and it was his idea, I guess, to make Xavier Onslaught and make him the traitor. And originally he didn't want that angle of Magneto infecting him. He wanted to just make Xavier the bad guy. And I remembered it being a conflict with editorial that they were like, no, we can't do that because this is Professor X. Essentially they were saying we're gonna have to bring him back eventually. But the research that I did was trying to track down exactly where the conflict there was. So I went through and found a CBR article. Now, I hate CBR in general, but
we will fight them here.
There was a column running a couple of years ago. It says April 4th, 2016, where G. Kendall was basically looking at old Wizard magazines and just kind of breaking them down and talking about the contents. And so this was from Wizard 59 in July of 1996. Aside, we asked last week, we were wondering if it was common knowledge that the Avengers and Fantastic Four, the Heroes Reborn stuff, was going to be a reboot type deal. And apparently that was common knowledge, because it says in the Wizard News section, Marvel headlines the news with the announcement the Onslaught crossover will lead into Heroes Reborn, and that Marvel's focus during the Heroes Reborn will be the heroes left behind, such as Black Widow and Quicksilver, etc. hyped for the Onslaught crossover, which has been trying to sell the idea that Onslaught is going to kill half of the Marvel universe. And I do remember those taglines, you know, Onslaught's going to kill half the Marvel universe. So apparently that was known, that like at the end of this story, they were going to be gone and they were going to have their own continuity, you know, separate from the standard Marvel universe. And then there was a second Wizard article, same author, Wizard number 65 in January of 1997. And there's this Q&A with Scott Lobdell, who is the co-writer of the X-Men books with Wade. And I'll just quote what he had to say about the Onslaught Xavier stuff. Scott Lobdell is interviewed offering his views on the recently completed Onslaught crossover, which he acknowledges was difficult for him to co-write. Lobdell disagreed with the efforts of quote-unquote some people. That's Mark Wade. To portray Xavier as, quote, this conflicted under the surface evil who has been dishonest with himself, unquote, and state that it's not his inclination to, quote, tell a story that's draped in this kind of cynicism. So the conflict, I guess, was between Lobdell and Wade. And Lobdell won, probably because editorial wanted to be able to redeem Xavier down the line. I also found a blog, Secrets Behind the X-Men. It's a Blogspot blog. There's another quote from Wade about the whole situation. Mm-hmm. Let me see if I can find it really quick.
While you're doing that, if I could just add this, I do love the fact that it isn't just the movies where the artists get notes and are told to do things because of future sales. That's fucking amazing.
In editorial's defense, it was another writer who also didn't like it. It wasn't just, I'm sure that's the ultimately where the decision lied. Bob Harris was the editor in chief at the time, and he was famously heavy handed with the X-Men stuff. So I'm sure that was kind of the final say was his. Mm-hmm. But
and that was not the only time. I was actually listening to a older episode of Cosmic Treadmill. They were talking about Mark Wade. That's not the only time he clashed with Bob Harris.
Oh, really?
They referenced the Professor X having a crush on Jean Grey, which is apparently really happened in an X-Men number 3. Stan Lee wrote that in.
I was wondering about that.
And then later they just kind of got rid of it because they didn't want to use it. But it says here, creepy. Many years later, Mark Wade took Jean Grey on a journey into Professor X's mind in X-Men 53, where she is confronted with the repressed memory. One of many that should have resulted in Professor X becoming the villain Onslaught. When it didn't, Mark Wade quit the title. Quote, it was always my conception that Onslaught was Professor X, pure and simple. He explained in Wizard Magazine number 90. That's probably the one I remember. The nonsense about adding Magneto's evil to that mix, to me, weakened the storyline and made the whole situation a lot less interesting.
He's not wrong.
Yeah, I kind of go back and forth on who I think was right on that. It would have been more interesting, I think, if Wade had kind of had his way.
This story, I think, is strongest if Magneto's a vegetable, Xavier's racked Xavier's racked with guilt. And then you start piling on top of that the legacy virus, the failure of Sabretooth to be healed, and the handful of other things that happen, and he just fucking snaps.
Failing over and over and over.
Yeah. And, you know, I would have done it as he snaps the moment cannonballs, like, but I don't think I'm good enough. You're not fucking good enough. And all this psionic energy comes out. The camera pans back, and there stands Onslaught, and he just kills all the X-Men.
And, you know, Wade, I think Harris was gone by this time, but Wade had another conflict a few years later with a Captain America story that they basically changed on him before it went to press, that led to him quitting, you know, that title by two or three years after this.
Wade, yeah. At that point, he was really like this. I mean, he'd been in the business for a while in different roles, but he was like rising star at that point. I think he had done Flash. His Captain America was getting rave reviews. Kingdom Come was released in 1996.
Right.
And so when one of the biggest writers came onto the biggest comic, like Lobdell was writing Uncanny and Wade was writing X-Men. It was a huge deal, and it didn't last 6 months.
I favor the idea of the object here is to sell books, not create high art. But the geniuses in both areas are able to do both. And I'm not a huge fan of change your art to reflect the need to sell books. But I'm also not a fan of I'm not interested in selling books. I just want to tell a nice story. I think both are counterproductive.
Like I said, Wade has had these conflicts, and I'm not saying it's all his fault. It may be that he's got the clout, and I mean.
mean, at this point, even still today, if Mark Waid wants to write a comic, somebody's going to publish it.
Oh, yeah.
So he didn't have to put up with stuff that, maybe other writers do. Like I said, on that Cosmic Treadmill where they were going through Waid's history, he's butted heads with editors more than a few times. And a lot of times he, you know, he'll say, hey, it's perfectly within their prerogative to do it. They own the character, but I just didn't feel like I could work on it anymore. I remember hearing some about this, you know, that he and Lobdell had clashed. And I mentioned on the last episode that I got X-Men 53 and 54 signed by Mark Waid at the Chicago Comic Con. And that was a couple years later. And I was kind of like, I wonder how he's going to react, because apparently he didn't have much fun. No, he was great. I said, this is one of the best comics I've ever read when he signed 54. And he's like, oh, thanks. That means a lot.
Oh, he's gracious. That's great. That's
yeah. Awesome.
All right. Well, let's move on. We'll go to X-Factor 125, and I'll do 126 also. X-Factor number 125, Onslaught Impact 1, The Ticking Clock. Story and art by Howard Mackey, Jeff Matsuda, and Al Milgram. In this issue, we jump back to a conversation between Onslaught and Dark Beast, McCoy. McCoy tells him he has someone in X-Factor that can help their cause, and it turns out to be Alex Summers, brother to Cyclops, who also goes by the name of Havoc. McCoy also convinces Fatal to teleport Sabretooth, Mystique, and a functional Sentinel to their side. However, the mutant team X-Factor is planning on tracking the Sentinel down. During all of this, Jean Grey's transmission plea for help goes unseen. X-Factor finds the Sentinel and faces off with Fatal and their former leader, Havoc. Another traitor in their midst, a team member by the name of Random, shows his hand. Forge finds out there are other Sentinels there, all prepared to launch against humanity. Another Onslaught lackey by the name of Post enters the fray, and as X-Factor battles, they look in horror as the Sentinels fly into the air. Part 2, Free For All. Story and art by Howard Mackey, Stefano Raphael, and Al Milgram. Sabretooth and Mystique are approached by Dark Beast, and he asks them if he'd like to join up with Onslaught. And as an offering of peace, he gives them Forge to kill. Untrusting of McCoy, Sabretooth and Mystique attack him. During the battle, McCoy is able to escape through one of Fatal's portals. Now, Forge realizes that the Hank McCoy he thought he knew as Beast was an imposter, and the real McCoy is out there somewhere. X-Factor 126, Onslaught Impact 2, The Beast Within. Story and art by Howard Mackey, Herb Trimpe, Stefano Raphael, and Al Milgram. Forge, Sabretooth, Wildchild, and Mystique make their way to find the real Hank McCoy. And even though Dark Beast attempted to deceive them through some doppelganger trickery, the team is successful finding the real Beast. With Hank at their side, they are able to subdue Fatal and Dark Beast. Upon reaching the surface, the team finds that their friend Polaris was gravely injured during the earlier battle, and demand Fatal transport them to a hospital. While the Dark Beast bides his time, as he states this is exactly where he wants to be. Chris, we're going to go right back to you. You said you liked Havoc's look here in these X-Factor issues. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I don't know what he's wearing. it's just like a
Armani
bodysuit with these red cables under his arms and over his shoulders.
I thought he was wearing a suit made of test patterns.
and yeah, it's got the, you know, the Havoc. What do they call his power blast things? I can't remember.
Oh my gosh.
Plasma. Why?
Thank you, plasma. It's yeah. Plasma.
So yeah, I can't explain what it is, but I think it looks cool. That's all. That was my only point.
Okay.
And, you know, Alex Summers is, you know, the forgotten Summers brother a lot of times. Like, nobody really likes Havoc. A few years after this, he would end up in the Mutant X book.
That's what I was going to say. I want to read that. What is that about?
That is we're in an episode or an issue of X-Factor. Yeah, they think he dies, essentially. And what happens is his consciousness or his soul or whatever is shunted off to another alternate reality's Alex Summers body. And it's like a much darker version of the X-Men, where
Storm's
he's the leader.
Vampire.
Yeah, Storm is a vampire.
Iceman has a hyphen in his name.
Crazy. Madeline Pryor is his wife. They're married. I forget who else is on the team. Call Archangel the Fallen, and he's more of like a demon than an angel.
Marvel should have published a drinking game that every time they use time travel or alternate reality, someone takes a drink.
This was an era where that kind of thing was unique still. We didn't see an alternate version of every character every 3 or 4 months like we do pretty much now. So Age of Apocalypse, Mutant X, those were kind of unique storylines at the time. Now I could care less when they reveal some new alternate universe, because like, how many are we gonna have to see? Although Howard Mackey wrote Mutant X, Jesse, so maybe they want to steer clear. I don't know. Jeez, but it was really good. It was only supposed to last 12 issues, and it did so well. It sold well, and it was well received. So they extended it, and then it kind of went downhill after that, because it was initially just supposed to be a 12-issue arc. It had an ending planned and everything, and then Havok was going to come back. But because they wanted to keep it going, it got stretched out, and it kind of petered out after that. But
Quick question, just because this was confusing me. I know Inferno was an older storyline. That's where we first meet Mr. Sinister, if I'm correct.
So. Around then, yeah.
Were there more than one Age of Apocalypses? Because they keep referencing that, but I thought Age of Apocalypse was an older story.
No, it was. It happened a little over a year before Onslaught.
Okay.
And now since then they've done sequels. They even did an ongoing Age of Apocalypse series where the timeline survived. Once a character or a concept, you know, sells in comics or just gets a couple fans, I mean, you know, a lot of the writers are fans too. Well, you know, we were talking about the Clone Saga and the backlash earlier. Dan Slott, over the course of his run on Spider-Man, brought back almost every element of that. And people are like, oh yeah, it's great. Like, didn't we all hate it? I mean, I love Dan Slott's run on Spider-Man, but I'm like, didn't we all hate this when it actually came out?
Chris wants to tell us about his favorite character, Random, as well, from what I understand.
Random? You know, it's not even really Random's fault. It's just like they're throwing these Onslaught crossover into, you know, Excalibur and X-Factor, where they've already got their own shit going on. They're just shoehorning it in. So now, like, if I want to read Onslaught, well, I got to read about Polaris and Random. Who gives a shit? Random sucks.
I don't know, man. I think on the top 10 list of the 90s-est characters. I mean, especially...
Yeah, but he's not the cool 90s version in this. He's a little twerp.
Well, that's just because he got smacked around.
Yeah.
This was Random the character that when we were doing Fatal Attractions, I was like, who is this dude? Dude.
Yeah, talked about him in that. Yeah.
All right, I thought so.
He's got the do-rag and like his weird...
He looks like Deathblow. He looks like a messed up...
He has an arm
Deathblow.
Gun.
But then when he gets beat up, he turns into a teenager, apparently, with a stupid haircut and shades.
Another issue that could have been, if we're going to do what we did in issue one or the book, the first trade paperback, I mean, this trade would have only been like, I don't know, half the size of book one then. And people would have been upset if they would have just cut everything out that didn't have anything to do with Onslaught. And that was a lot.
I like Jeff Matsuda's art. I'll say that.
Okay.
He does the first half of the first X Factor book and then some other guy takes over. He's okay. But I like Matsuda quite a bit.
Yeah. And X Factor and Howard Mackey, okay, just saying. I honestly think when we hit the Spider-Man issue, I had no problem with that. I know I put this on the chat, but I'm going to say it here so our listeners can understand. I think Howard Mackey's, what he's got to try and do is he's got to try and cram in all this backstory all at once. You understand where all these characters are coming from in the X-Factor. And X-Factor has like 120 members, I swear.
Back then, you weren't guaranteed that everything was going to get collected in a trade 2 months later.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. He crams all this stuff in there, and there was just... I'm trying to get through this today, so I'm like, I got to finish this book before we do the podcast. That would probably be a good idea. So I'm reading through X-Factor 125, and I'm just like, this is a double-sized issue. Shoot me now. But, you know, I made it through. And then when we hit the Spider-Man issue, that wasn't as bad. And I think the reason is because he only had two characters. The Sentinels are kind of one note. And then you have Ben Reilly and Spider-Man. So everything seemed to flow a lot better there. So I'll give Howard Mackey this. I think the problem was he just had a lot of a lot of stuff on his plate he had to get across. Evan, tell me about the final showdown between the beasts. You said you liked that because real McCoy has showed up finally.
Yeah, I love that. And that one stuck with me for a while, although I remember it being a bit longer.
Yeah, that lasted like a page and a half.
Yeah, but, you know, so they have the thing where Sabretooth, and can I just say that Sabretooth, I mean, he had been hanging out with the X-Men for a while. They kept playing with the idea of making him a hero, and I don't know that he's heroic so much as he just wants to be evil on his own time, you know, so where the Dark Beast is like, go ahead and kill Forge. He's like, kill who I want to kill. I'm going to kill somebody just because you tell me to. But, so, yeah, I just think Sabretooth is like, oh, hey, I'm going to do my own thing. Putting aside the fact that in Onslaught X-Men, we saw the real McCoy get free.
He, like, makes his way out of there somehow, and I was like, there's got to be a missing issue because...
I no-prized my way out of that one.
Okay.
The person that he saw was Dark Beast, who was like, get back in your hole.
Totally confused Wild Child and Sabretooth. I honestly thought they were the same character.
Well, Wild Child... let me get off on that tangent. Wild Child didn't come from Age of Apocalypse, but he's in there because of Age of Apocalypse, because he was an Alpha Flight character. And or at least that's where I am first aware of him from. And in Age of Apocalypse, someone was like, you know what would be cool is if we make Sabretooth a hero and he's got a mini-me chained to him the whole time. And so apparently that stuck around and they're like, we got to get Wild Child back into the regular comics. I know, let's put him on X-Factor. I wasn't reading X-Factor at that point, but that's how I imagined it went. But so, yeah, so Sabretooth finds the real McCoy and they're fighting and their trunks are changing colors. I think that was just a coloring error. I love the part, and it's vintage Hank McCoy, where, you know, Dark Beast is trying to convince them, and, you know, we talked last time about how he is not as articulate or verbose as the real McCoy. Forge is like, yeah, I'm starting to think Sabretooth might be right, and Dark Beast goes, stars and garters, man, use the brain with which you were blessed. I'm the real McCoy. He's the imposter, and that's when Hank loses it. Ripped up in a wall. This guy is, you know, done who knows what, masquerading as him. And he's like, Hank goes, you may bamboozle my friends. You may even try to kill me. But when you steal an idiom, which I worked so hard to coin, you have stepped way over the line.
Yeah, that was fucking hilarious.
And, I mean, that, you know, we briefly mentioned, I think, Mark, you said last week, you couldn't, you can only hear the Beast speaking in Kelsey Grammer's voice.
Yep.
I had a lot of issues with X-Men 3, but when Kelsey Grammer said, oh, my stars and garters perfectly, I was like, yes, this is an okay movie. The lowest it's going to get for me on IMDb is a 6, because they nailed the most important part.
Agreed.
That is how you prove you're Hank McCoy. There's no DNA test. It's, I'm going to get ticked off over this stupid thing because I have worked hard on that joke, and that is my catchphrase, and how dare you, sir.
Kelsey Grammer was great, you know, as Beast in that terrible movie.
I still terrible, always you mean hear, amazing.
I still always hear animated series Beast and Wolverine and Cyclops, pretty much every character from the animated series is how I hear every voice in my head.
Can't blame you.
I'm with you there.
Cannot blame you. All right. Well, let's hop into the Sensational Spider-Man number 8, The Usual Suspects. And this
do we
one
have to?
The Sensational Spider-Man number 8, The Usual Suspects. Story and art by Todd DeZago, Mike Wieringo, and Richard Case. We are following the Ben Reilly Spider-Man, who discovers that Norton G. Fester, the looter, has been using the tools of other villains to commit crimes in order to remain unknown as the perpetrator. Once Spider-Man is able to confront and capture the looter, sitting atop a building, he is taken by surprise when 5 gigantic sentinels fly over his head. Yeah, the last panel was Spider-Man, the Ben Reilly Spider-Man, looking up and seeing all these sentinels. Well, there's like 5 sentinels fly over his head. And that's
they easily could have just used those last 2 pages the way they did with the Fantastic Four issues in the first volume and whatnot.
All they had to do was do that. But
I'm glad this is included because I'm always down to read any comic that Mike Ringo did the art on.
Yes.
I don't know how familiar any of you guys are. I'm sure Evan's pretty familiar with him. Passed away about 10 or 12 years ago early, unfortunately. But I was a huge fan of his, and he draws a great Spider-Man. He's got a really cartoony, I guess, art style.
In the best way.
Yeah, in a great way.
All right, well, let me just slip in here and talk about the Sensational Spider-Man controversy, because this was something that I wasn't collecting at the time it came out. Again, there were 47 Spider-Man
47,
titles.
Yeah.
So I caught this from the wiki. I'm going to read
that's
this
That's why
quick.
They cloned him.
That's no wonder. No wonder.
Peter couldn't handle that workload on his own.
No, he could not.
Turned to Peter out.
So, yeah, this was about the most interesting thing I could find about Sensational Spider-Man. It says, in the initial seven issues, 0 through 6, January through July of 1996, were written and penciled by Dan Jurgens, who had helped revive interest in Superman for DC Comics in the mid-1990s. Jurgens pushed strongly for the restoration of Peter Parker as the true Spider-Man, and plans were made to enact this soon. But, here's that name again, Bob Harris, the new editor-in-chief, demanded the story be deferred until after the Onslaught crossover. Jurgens had by this stage become disillusioned with the immense amount of group planning and constant changes of ideas and directions, and took this as the last straw, resigning from the title. So, yeah, this is two issues after that separation there. Now, I don't know if he resigned from Marvel. I would assume that if you say, hey, I'm resigning from a Spider-Man title, you're probably not going to be thrown too much for Marvel after that.
He was back 2 years later doing Thor.
Yeah, I was going to say, you said he was back shortly there afterwards. His name is Dan. I mean, it's Dan Jurgens, for Pete's sake, because that he did a great job of bringing back interest in Superman. So, anyway.
It is odd that he would cite groupthink or whatever, considering those Superman titles were essentially you were writing a fourth of a story every month.
Oh, true. That's true.
maybe that started becoming more of a thing after he left Superman, but I'm pretty sure it was going on when he was there.
Yeah.
Where each issue basically led. It was basically a weekly Superman book.
Mm-hmm. And then we get into Amazing Spider-Man 415. Amazing Spider-Man number 415, Onslaught Impact 2, Siege. Story and art by Tom DeFalco, Mark Bagley, Larry Maustead, and Al Milgram. The Sentinels declare they have been ordered by Onslaught to lock down the city under martial law. Just as Peter Parker was leaving the hospital with his wife. As a Sentinel attacks Peter, he escapes with his wife, but other masses of Sentinels wreak havoc across New York. Peter Parker has been having problems with his powers, and while on the run from a Sentinel, he loses his powers yet again. However, when this happens, the Sentinel no longer consider him a threat and leaves. Meanwhile, Ben Reilly dons the Spider-Man costume to try and bring some order to the neighborhood he is in, as rioting has begun. However, he is soon targeted by another Sentinel. Battling the Sentinel, Ben is able to overcome it by completely ripping its head apart, and he plans to bring the fight to the rest of the Sentinels in the city. I really didn't have much to say about this one. Neither did you guys. I mean, there wasn't anything I listed here. Ben Reilly dons the Spider-Man costume to try and bring some order to his neighborhood. And then battling the Sentinel, Ben is able to overcome it by completely ripping its head apart, which was pretty cool to see Ben Reilly get in there and show how strong he was.
Get to see him use his impact webbing, which was a Dan Jurgens creation. I like the Ben Reilly Spider-Man costume. You know, it's really similar to the standard costume, but it's its own unique thing. And I'm always down to watch or to read a Mark Bagley Spider-Man comic. So it's not, you know, it's not essential reading. I mean, I guess it's the complete Onslaught, so they threw it in there. But it's got some fun action stuff with him fighting Sentinels in it.
Yeah, this is really what we get into here. These next few issues, aside from X-Men 18 and X-Force, our heroes dealing with the Sentinels coming to New York City. And so that's really kind of how Onslaught is impacting the Marvel Universe.
I was just going to throw in, for all the people downloading this podcast specifically to hear me talk about it, Volume 2 was the only one I couldn't get through my library, and I did not pick up any of the Spider-Man and Punisher titles the first time around, so I am out of the loop on these.
Okay, all right.
So my thought on this, on Volume 2, is very much, you know, that the writer in the writer's room, they're all sitting around a table going, you know, when we do these crossovers, there's really not a lot of thought put into, well, what are the other superheroes doing during these big event moments? What if we dedicated entire books to just that? And it's like, you know, and now that they've done that, never do it again. just tell the story. Oh. I don't need to. And while Onslaught was happening, Joe Schmo did, like, really? Well,
they still pretty much do that, but now rather than having those stories run in their main titles, they do, you know, now it would be Spider-Man Onslaught 1 through 3.
Oh, yeah.
Show what Spider-Man's doing.
Age of Ultron, AU1.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, jeez. Yeah.
Right. But it does give the writers and artists of the main books the option to not jump into the big crossovers, and they can kind of keep doing their own thing. So,
doing their own
those, you know, Age of Ultron, Spider-Man, or whatever, are usually garbage and not worth reading.
And a lot of times they're collected in a separate, like when I was reading the ones I had for this, because I mean, there's some interesting stories, but nothing that really trips the main story. I thought maybe it would have made more sense to do like an Onslaught Phase 1 and 2 trade and an Onslaught Impact 1 and 2 trade. Because in one of the ads, they had like a checklist and it had different orders and even left some of them out. I think some of this was kind of arbitrary. I don't think these were all planned to be read in a particular order. I mean, some of them obviously depend on others, but I mean, I was just buying stuff as I saw it. You know, it wasn't, except for a couple of them, and like they'll say, continued in this issue, but otherwise it was, there's not a strong through line on some of these, if that's even a term.
Here's the thing. If you really want to tell what some of these heroes were doing during the Sentinel attack in New York, two pages.
Yeah.
two pages was all you needed.
Agreed.
In like a main Onslaught book. Meanwhile, in Manhattan, you know, and you see the superheroes fight the things. Okay, we get it. I don't need an entire book dedicated to this.
Yeah, I'm really kind of scared of what we're going to get in part three. I mean, I don't know what it's going to contain. I can't remember.
Fucking damage control.
It goes back to the main story.
Yeah, at least we'll get some X-Men in the next volume. Okay.
Oh, no. At this point, I'm hoping we get an entire... I'm hoping volume three is all damage control. But like damage control doing city planning, damage control doing debris cleanup, damage control starting to erect buildings, damage control applying for permits.
I don't want to be a part of your universe, Mark Radulich.
Well, there are comics like that.
I was going to say, Mark is a fan of the damage control. I know
it was
that
four
much.
Issues and it was hilarious. And they only needed to do it once.
I just want to real quick ask this, and I could be completely wrong. Into the Spider-Verse, the movie. All right, yes. Was Miles Morales, his universe had a blonde-haired Spider-Man, right?
Yep.
There was the classic Spider-Man that was separated or divorced from Mary Jane Watson, and then there was the newer, let's call him the Dan Slott Spider-Man, who gets shot in the face by Kingpin.
Okay, but he was blonde-headed. He had blonde hair, right?
Right.
Okay. Now, Ben Reilly in the 616 here, if you notice, has blonde hair.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he, and of course, during the Clone Saga, they were saying he was the actual Spider-Man all along before everything else got turned around. But what if the blonde-headed Spider-Man in Spider-Verse was actually Ben Reilly, but no clone?
Jesse, you just blew my mind.
Jesse, were you in the writer's room getting high with them when they came up with this concept?
All right, Green Goblin number 12. Here we go.
Oh, speaking of, let's not focus on every single character in the Marvel Universe. Go on.
Green Goblin number 12, Onslaught Impact 2, Even the Brave Can Fall. Story and art by Tom DeFalco, Josh Hood, and Derek Fisher. Nephew of Daily Bugle employee Ben Urich, Philip Urich, is the new, not-so-villainous Green Goblin. A New York resident as well, he has been watching his city become overcome with Onslaught-controlled Sentinels. When Phil and his uncle make it to the Daily Bugle, it is attacked by a Sentinel, cutting the power and hampering their ability to get news out. It is at this time that the reluctant Phil Urich becomes the Green Goblin and takes the battle to the Sentinel. Getting his mask, the source of his power, knocked off during the battle, Phil begins to realize he may not be the hero he believes himself to be. Stealing himself, he reaches for the mask and puts it back on. Attacking the Sentinel, Green Goblin sends his glider through its head, destroying it. During this, Phil suffers a blow to his mask, rendering it inoperative, potentially ending Phil's stint as the Green Goblin as we know it.
Phil Urich is the kind of guy who, if he were around in 2019, he's dead now, by the way.
Yes.
if Phil Urich were on Facebook, his Facebook statuses would constantly be like, just don't know if I'm going to make it today, guys. Having a real tough time today, guys. And just alluding to bullshit that he wouldn't actually talk about. Like, what a whiner.
Poor guy. Phil Urich.
I bought the trade of the Green Goblin solo book, which was like 12 issues a couple of years ago, thinking I would read it one day. And now I'm like, I'm never going to read this shit.
Not a fan.
Yeah,
not
it's. Am I wrong? Was it not really bad?
No, he was. He definitely now, had a.
Some of the other issues do have Scott McDaniel on the art, which is the main reason I bought it. So okay. I can still thumb through it, okay. But I don't know that I'm ever going to actually read it.
So anyway, yeah, Green Goblin shows up. He tries to do a few things. He gets real emo, and then his mask gets broken. All right, good deal. Spider-Man number 72, Onslaught Impact 2, The World's Gone Mad. Story and art by Howard Mackey, John Romita Jr., and Al Williamson. On a rooftop, Peter Parker, just narrowly escaping death from a Sentinel, is trying to get some good pictures for the Bugle, when in swings his clone, Ben Reilly, being chased by Sentinels. When it appears Ben is going to get caught, Peter throws something and hits the face of a Sentinel, getting its attention. Now, both Peter and Ben have to rely on each other to eliminate the three Sentinels that are after them. When Ben takes a shot to the back, Peter helps save him, and the two make a plan to destroy the Sentinels. Ben disables one, and Peter uses his on-again, off-again spider powers to detach a Sentinel's head, swinging it into the other two. Now, Ben and Peter must focus on ridding the city of the rest of the Sentinels, and also join the Avengers and X-Men in fighting Onslaught. This is where Ben Reilly and Peter Parker team up and take out some Sentinels. So I don't have any notes other than Clone Saga, Clone Saga, Clone Saga, Clone Saga.
Right, I'm sick of it.
I just the cover that's the one I tracked down. The cover says this month's must read Marvel comic, and in a lot of the ads for it, they were talking about how Onslaught would affect the rest of the Marvel universe, including ending the career of the new Green Goblin and setting in motion the events that would lead to the return of the one true Spider-Man. And I'm like, oh, so this must be pretty important.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a good story, but
it's just them beating the crap out of Sentinels.
I don't. Yeah,
which when Romita Jr. is doing it is great. But
yeah. I mean, it's not bad, but it just.
Put that tagline on it if it's not going to be like this crucial, you know, Spider-Man beats up Onslaught finally. Oh, crap. Okay. Bring it on. But
God, wouldn't that be hilarious, though? I'm just, you know, like, oh, we have this huge X-Men crossover, these really powerful mutants, and Spider-Man takes out Onslaught. Like, what? What's going on, guys? What's the problem?
Cosmic right. Spider-Man could do it.
No doubt.
But yeah, there are six double-page splash pages.
That's right. You mentioned there was issue, a lot. And
they're pretty much all fantastic. So,
I mean, this is Romita Jr., Spider-Man, I love seeing. I mean, he's a good artist, but there's some characters that I don't, for me anyway, his style doesn't work on him. He's an awesome artist. But Spider-Man is I mean, that's him at the top of his game.
Yeah. I've always thought that him on Thor and Hulk was pretty much a perfect match, but he's probably done more Spider-Man than anything in his career. He's great.
Moving on here, we're back to the mutants, ladies and gentlemen. X-Men 18 and X-Force 57, two-part story. Actually, it's a three-part story. We just don't get the third part in this book, and I really hope it's in volume 3. I'd imagine it has to be.
X-Men number 18, Onslaught Phase 1, and the Company of Strangers Part 1. Story and art by Terry Cavanaugh, Steve Scroese, Bud LaRosa, and Rob Hunter. We rejoin Nate Gray at the Xavier Institute as he is currently being guarded by Domino, Sunspot, Caliban, Meltdown, Shatterstar, and Siren, the members of the X-Force. As Sunspot is attempting to repair mansion security, everyone is on high alert for Onslaught, but no one is expecting the appearance of Mr. Sinister. When the fight begins, Nate puts up a valiant effort but succumbs to the power of Mr. Sinister. X-Force 57, Onslaught Impact 1, and the Company of Strangers Part 2. Story and art by Jeff Lowe, Anthony Castrillo, and Mark Morales. After besting Nate Gray and shutting down his near-limitless power before Sinister is able to make another move, X-Force member Caliban ferociously attacks, buying enough time for some of the team to escape with X-Man. While others are keeping Sinister at bay, Nate must figure out a way to restart his powers, and that knowledge lies in the Ascani teachings in the head of Sunspot. Nate reaches out and restarts his psionics, facing off again with Sinister. Appearing to have beat him, Sinister tricks Nate into reading his mind, but then using that same power to feed back and attack the rest of the team. The issue ends with Sinister walking away with X-Man carried over his shoulder.
my notes for this, the only reason I really, really liked this issue was knowing the history of X-Man, because he was one of my favorite characters in the 90s, and Sinister from Age of Apocalypse. So those two had this huge, you know, they had a big history together. When Nate sees Mr. Sinister here, it's the first time he's seen him since he killed Mr. Sinister. I don't know what he was called. I can't remember what he was called over in Age of Apocalypse.
I think it was just Mr. Sinister.
Okay.
He had that mustache. He was Senior Sinister.
Senior Sinister.
I may have made that up.
You have killed my father. All right. So anyway, yeah, he kills him over in Age of Apocalypse. X-Man kills Sinister over there, and then he sees him over here for the first time, and that was kind of a big deal. And Nate's interaction with the team of X-Force was led by Cable. Cable's been gone for a while, and to see this kind of, you know, this alternate world Cable kind of working with the team was pretty neat too.
I remember it was big to me because Sinister was always obsessed with the Summers and Gray bloodlines.
Yep.
And he's the one, after Jean Gray died, I'm doing air quotes because you guys can see me on the audio. He's the one that cloned her as Madeline Pryor, fixed her up with Cyclops so that he could still, because he believed that bloodline was the key to the mixing of those bloodlines was the key to defeating Apocalypse.
Yep.
And then Apocalypse was like, hey, I gave your ultimate weapon kit a techno-organic virus. And so X-Man was Sinister doing that in the Age of Apocalypse timeline, and he's Cable without the, without having to devote most of his powers to keeping the techno-organic virus from killing him.
Yeah.
So he's Cable without the restraints.
This is where Sinister's like, okay, I've actually got my weapon now.
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
I was going to mention Steve Skros, or I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name, honestly. I think it's Steve Skros.
Sure.
Who did the X-Men or X-Man issue. And this was the first I'd ever seen. I wasn't reading X-Man at the time because I was just getting back into comics, but I picked up this issue as part of the crossover. And he would go on to do Gambit shortly after this and then kind of disappeared forever. He'd storyboarded the Matrix movies. I think the only other comics he's done in like the last 20 years, it seems like, was a book for, was it, did he do Doc Frankenstein?
Do not know.
Anybody know? I think he did that for the Wachowskis. And then he did a Brian K. Vaughan Image book about 2 years ago. So he's kind of was a big deal for a couple of years and then just disappeared. And that's unfortunate because I really like his artwork.
Yeah, it's definitely different.
This is really not him at his best, honestly.
Well, look,
it seemed like he was starting to come into his own around this time, and the Gambit issues were really good, and then he kind of was gone after that. I think he did Spider-Man. So he was doing one of the Spider-Man titles for a while, too.
Okay. Isn't it weird? And this just might be for you guys, but I mean, we have a lot of the story taking place in Manhattan and New York City and all that. It's so weird to see the World Trade Centers, the buildings throughout the books and just be taken back to that. Let's move on here to Punisher number 11, our final book.
Punisher number 11, Onslaught Impact 2, Manhattan Onslaught. Story and art by John Ostrander, Tom Lyle, and Robert Jones. The Punisher is on the street dealing with the chaos brought about from the Sentinel's appearance. Over the river, the SHIELD helicarrier is attacked and brought down. Meanwhile, a team of thugs going by the name of the Junkyard Dogs plan to claim the helicarrier as salvage, intent on killing anyone alive on the ship. Luckily, the Punisher shows up to lend a hand, and the self-destruct goes off, blasting the helicarrier to pieces. After this, SHIELD operative G.W. Bridge has Punisher commit to helping them with a mutant terrorist group, as after all, he owes SHIELD. What was this debt for, according to G.W. Bridge? Frank was drugged out of his mind and recently killed Nick Fury.
SHIELD helicarrier is attacked and brought down into the river. Then Punisher makes the decision to jump in there and help them out. And we have some junkyard dogs. The junkyard dogs, these thugs that have decided that, oh, the helicarrier is now going to be salvage, and we're going. What a goofy concept.
Yeah. What? This is just a street gang that like their thing is illegally salvaging stuff out of the river. They've got their own jet skis with logos on it. What?
I don't think the writer of this book knows how crime works.
Yeah, it's a little off the beaten path. Really,
John Ostrander. Dang.
Yeah, I've heard his name before. I can't remember. It's a very good possibility we may have covered a book on here by
most
him.
Most famous for Suicide Squad, I think.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, the end
result.
Well,
they all had matching jet skis, I believe.
That's his call sign. Okay, you know he's on a book if all the characters have jet skis. Yeah, the end result of this is Punisher hops on there, helps GW Bridge out, and GW Bridge is like, hey, listen, you know, we need your help. We're kind of outgunned here. We're outmanned. There is a mutant terrorist group that's apparently on the loose, and we need you to take care of them because you owe us. And Punisher's like, what the hell do I owe you for? Well, you killed Nick Fury. You were on drugs, but you killed Nick Fury. Oh, okay. Well, I guess I owe you one.
Yeah, there's a moment
we all killed Nick Fury in a drug-fueled rage.
There's a panel where on this last page where GW Bridge is saying all this stuff and like you owe S.H.I.E.L.D. and whatnot. And then the girl has this thought bubble. What the devil are they talking about? And I was like, that's what I want to know.
They're setting
know
exactly something up.
How you feel. I don't know what's going on. I just want to get out of this comic and move on to the next one. Although it really wasn't. I mean, it was a fine 90s Punisher as a Marvel superhero comic or whatever.
Yeah.
The only thing that I can add, but I do think it's important, is that the G and the W in GW Bridge literally do stand for George Washington.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many times that confused the fuck out of me, because I'm like, are they talking about the actual bridge or the person?
You know, I've got an affinity for GW Bridge just because he was like in charge of S.H.I.E.L.D. when I started reading comics.
I don't honestly know thought Nick now Fury you were doing. Talking about the bridge.
I was not. But I don't know what Nick Fury was doing at that time. But yeah, so Bridge kind of is never around anymore, it doesn't seem like. I don't know when the last time I saw him pop up in a comic was. But
he did a limited series about him and his siblings, Brooklyn and Golden Gate.
Oh, jeez.
He was a part of that team, the BQE. Oh.
Sorry, I brought him up.
Chris is like, I hate coming on here.
Oh, that's great. Tom Lyle's art, by the way, I think I really criticized his art. Was he part of the... He's part of the Maximum Crush.
Probably, because I know him best as a Spider-Man artist around the time after McFarlane and Eric Larson had left that book.
I was going to say, if you listen to our discussion on Maximum Carnage, I think that was one of the artists that I gave a hard time to.
Yeah.
And I think in this issue, I was really worried when I saw his name, and I'm very surprised. He's come a long way, if that's the case. Well, that was 93 with Maximum Carnage, right? 93, 94?
94, I think.
Mm-hmm. And that were a couple years afterwards, and he's really improved.
And it seems like this is more his speed, more of, you know, street level hero. Or, you know, the S.H.I.E.L.D. agents and stuff like that, the gang, like not so much Spider-Man type superheroic stuff. I don't know that he's best suited for something like that, but he does a fine job with this issue. It's fine.
Yeah, it don't look bad. All right, well, we've come to the end of Onslaught Week 2. This is the complete epic Book 2. We are done. Get us out of this comic, as Chris Armstrong said. I just want to end the issue. Let's go around real quick. Final thoughts. We'll get into plugs. Mark Radulich, final thoughts on the Book 2 of the complete Onslaught epic.
The stuff that dealt with Hank McCoy, the Xavier protocols, Wolverine, and Mr. Sinister was fine. That's the stuff I liked. The stuff I could have done without was entire issues dedicated to Spider-Man fighting Sentinels and dealing with this clone fella.
Okay. All right, Chris Armstrong, final thoughts.
I guess I'm almost in the opposite.
Okay.
It's like the mutant themed issues, while they did move the Onslaught stuff along some more, there was just too much stuff I didn't care about with some of the other characters. Whereas the Spider-Man books were just Spider-Man beating the crap out of Sentinels by artists that I really liked. So those were a lot of fun for me. The Green Goblin issue was terrible. And the Punisher issue was passable. So uneven. The first volume was much better. But looking forward to volume 3.
All right. Very good. And Evan Bevins, please.
You have to be in, you have to be in the middle now because Chris and I are on opposite sides.
Well, actually, I was going to, since I didn't complete the assignment, I got a little, I brought a little extra credit.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I had a note on here for you to tell us about the Generation X stuff.
Speaking of the complete Onslaught epic and comics that don't have a lot to do with Onslaught, Generation X was like the next big thing, or had been, a year earlier. And there were two issues of Generation X that were branded with Onslaught. And it's possible they had less to do with the story than Excalibur. Although they were all, the two-part story was motivated entirely by Onslaught.
Oh, okay.
But basically, they're coming back on Emma Frost, the White Queen. She and Banshee were the headmasters of the school, and they were coming back from something that happened in issue 17, which I read 22 years ago. Emma mind controls Banshee into jumping out of the plane, but it's okay, he can fly. Has the plane fly to Canada to her private estate. The initial thought is, oh, she's turning evil again, because Emma had only been a good guy for like less than 2 years at this point, so everybody was kind of waiting for her to go evil. But it turns out that she was her last team of youngsters, the Hellions, died pretty horribly. And so she was trying to protect Generation X and also got caught in some sort of psychic backlash caused by Onslaught. Now, granted, this psychic backlash didn't affect Cable, X-Man, Jean Grey, people who were standing right next to him. Huh. But be that as it may, it was an offbeat story. Chris Bocciello did the art, very stylized offbeat. He's one of those artists that is good, but I like his art on some things better than others. And this one was very strange, especially when Emma starts mind controlling the Generation X kids and Jubilee dresses up and starts talking like a gangster. Sync is a hippie. Monet is a cheerleader. And Paige, a.k.a. Husk, a.k.a. Cannonball's little sister, who's also from Kentucky, dresses up as a clown. And they run afoul of the Toad.
All right, then.
And they never see Onslaught. But, I mean, but it was, you know, so we've got all these Spider-Man issues and other things. And I do think it's cool when you try to rope others in. But here are two specifically X-Men comics, branded Onslaught, not vital to the story, but certainly not any less related than some of the other titles we got. So I just thought it was interesting that of all the stuff they pulled in, including stuff in volumes 1 and 4 that happened before and technically after the story, there was no room for Generation X.
Yeah, that's sad. That's real sad. So any other thoughts on the second volume here?
No, I'm pretty much agreed with Mark and Chris there. Is that middle of the road enough for you? I mean, you know, the ones I read, they contribute something to the story, maybe not much in some places, but I don't know. It's just this second volume just seems to have the least meat from what I've looked ahead at what each volume has. And for what I remember reading, like I said, I don't think this was written as a completely linear story with some of these tie-ins. I think maybe there might be a better way to collect them. But I mean, it all goes, you know, to the grand scope of it. And like Chris was saying, you don't see a crossover these days that affects as much as it did. I mean, there were still, you flip through you know, some of the original comics with the ads, there was other stuff going on in other titles. There was one Spider-Man book that didn't have anything to do with it. Daredevil, I don't think, was ever related to it. Doctor Strange pops up in that X-Men Unlimited I was talking about that isn't in any of the trades. You know, there were a few, but this really did affect everybody. And like I said last time, it was, you know, with the backlash on Spider-Man and some other things, this was really, you know, the X-Men like, hey, come in here. Get in here. There's room for all of us. Let's all, you know, come together and, you know, link arms and get our butts kicked by Onslaught.
Yeah, yeah. We got to show that this is affecting the Marvel Universe, and I understand that that's the purpose of the book.
It takes two pages.
That's the purpose. Hey, Chris said it earlier. The complete epic. It's not, you know, hey.
I'm all for complete epics, but I don't need an entire book of, and then Spider-Man fought the Sentinels. And then he fought the Sentinels. But then...
Yeah, but in one of them, Peter helped him fight the Sentinels. See?
Oh, right. My God. I stand corrected. I'm sorry. Please.
But at least that issue was all about Peter Parker fighting the Sentinels. I mean, Excalibur had a good excuse not to answer the phone, but, I mean, you know, that one, you could have lifted six pages out of it.
Yeah.
So at least those other ones, they were, you know, they were doing their thing, helping the fight against the Onslaught.
It's true. All right, well, that brings our discussion of Volume 2 to a close. We're going to be talking about Volume 3 there next week. Better get to reading. Start reading now, because if you end up like me, you're going to be wishing you had a third holiday again next week.
Yeah, I was ahead of the curve on the last two. I haven't read any of Volume 3 yet, so I'll be trying to rush.
I had to fit all of today in to finish like six of the eight issues that were in this. So I'm glad we had a holiday in order to get this discussed.
Maybe a hurricane will hit Ohio and you can stay home too.
Maybe, Mark, maybe. All right, let's get into plugs. We'll start with Evan this time. Evan Bevins, let everybody know where people can find you, what you got planned, what you doing.
Well, I'm doing really bad at plugs right now.
Yeah.
let's
goes
see.
Without saying, literally.
Got support group, a webcomic about a support group for people with lame superpowers, in case your origin doesn't turn out the way they show it in the comics. You can find that on Facebook and on Webtoons. Also write for Graffiti, West Virginia Entertainment Magazine, where I talk about various comic topics. Let's see. This month might be who the Marvel Cinematic Universe can tap to replace Spider-Man, although I think they're still going to get a deal done. But
cross your fingers.
Just in case, yeah. Hint, Gravity. Or Squirrel Girl. There, I did it.
Lord. There it is.
Squirrel Girl would be in line with their current modus operandi. We don't have any male superheroes. What are you talking about? Hashtag woke.
But Squirrel Girl's awesome. That's the thing about Squirrel Girl.
Anyway. I'm not debating that.
Yeah. Let's see. And I guess with Titans Season 2 getting ready to come out, I'll be writing to folks who maybe aren't as familiar with comics about where Deathstroke comes from.
Wait, I thought Deathstroke came from the Arrowverse. He was on that island.
Yeah. Okay. he was a late addition. At some point, they were like, hey, you know who doesn't have any enemies? Green Arrow. The Titans aren't doing much now. Let's give him Deathstroke. Yeah, he was totally a Titans character. And they were like, maybe they can get in a fight and Green Arrow can shove an arrow in his empty eye socket. And then, you know, they'll have a beef.
Brilliant. Chris Armstrong, let everybody know where you're at.
I'm on Twitter at BrodyMan34. Also do the Unspoken Issues podcast with Jesse. Hopefully, by the time this is up, there will already be a new issue or a new episode of that. We did Spider-Man and Batman by Mark Bagley and Jim DeMatteis. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot more talk about the Clone Saga on there, as well as Mark Bagley doing Spider-Man. That should be out probably by the time this is out, so check that out.
All right, very good. Mark Radulich, what's the schedule, bro?
All right, so this Tuesday, which is tomorrow, we'll be reviewing It, Chapter 2. Despite vicious rumors and takedowns of my person, I did not conjure Hurricane Dorian to get me out of having to see a horror movie, you bastards. I saw It, Chapter 2, despite the weather, and it was a fine movie, and we'll review it tomorrow. Well, on Wednesday, we'll be reviewing the new Kill Switch Engage, Atonement, and definitely more up my speed, She-Ra Season 3 this Thursday. And we'll take a break Friday, but Saturday night's all right for fights, if you ask me. We got Pat Mullen and I on a watch-along. We'll be doing alternative commentary for Bloodsport, Josh Barnett's Bloodsport 2. We may or may not have a review of Clash of the Champions. I don't know just yet. But you can also check out our alternative commentary for UFC 242, Khabib versus Poirier. You can check out our reviews of Hannibal Season 3, our TV parties for New Japan, Royal Quest, NXT UK TakeOver Cardiff, and AEW All Out. We did a special extra source material for X-Men Legacy Volume 2, Invasive Exotics. Happy Jack, Jesse. Happy Jack.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of Happy Jack, Jesse and I got through painfully Legion Season 3, and we talked all about it last Thursday. So go ahead in the archives and check that out.
You know, check out the Patreon. Mark Radulich said nobody goes there. We haven't had time for everybody to go there yet. Trust me. All sorts of great content over there. You can pay $1 a month, listen to PodCoin, probably make that back. And then it's everything evens out and you get extra bonus content along with it. I mean, I don't understand why you're not doing that already. But yeah, check out PodCoin. We're on there. Listen to podcasts, get paid for it. Check out Patreon. We got some stuff on there, extra content. You can customize your donation per month. But other than that, I will throw the rest of the can plugs in here at the end. For Mark Radulich, for Chris Armstrong, for Evan Bevins, I am Jesse Starcher. We'll catch you next week. Onslaught continues. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
Hey, everybody. I really do hope you love the Radulich and Broadcasting Network. Did you know that you can actually get paid just for listening to this podcast? I know it sounds insane, but it's true. We just discovered this free new app called PodCoin, and it literally pays you to listen to podcasts. Here's how it works. You listen to podcasts and you earn PodCoin while you listen. Then you turn that PodCoin in for gift cards at places like Amazon or Starbucks, or if you're a good person, you could even donate that PodCoin to charity. The more you listen, the more you earn. Here's what you do. Download the app right now on iPhone or Android, and I have a special code for you. Simply use our code MARKWED5, that's capital M-A-R-K-W-E-D 5. Capital M-A-R-K-W-E-D 5. MARKWED5. And you'll get 300 PodCoin just for signing up. And if you listen to enough of us on there, you can get a cappuccino at Starbucks or an Amazon gift card on us. So go ahead and go listen to this podcast or virtually any podcast on PodCoin and sign up with code MARKWED5. I swear it'll change the way you listen to podcasts.
Thank you all for joining us. Make sure to give that Radulich in Broadcasting Facebook page a like to stay up on top of all the great podcasts we have to offer. We are at home on Spreaker, but you can also find us on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and recently we have hit the air on Spotify. Find your favorite podcast platform and type in RADULICH to subscribe for some great content. If you enjoyed this show, please feel free to share and spread the word. And as always, we appreciate any feedback and look forward to entertaining you again soon.
We certainly don't need to do that.
Why are you yelling into your microphone?
I'm looking at the cover to Excalibur number 100, and I think there's a chance Nightcrawler is naked.
All right, you guys ready?
Not if you keep yelling into the microphone.
I thought...
Fucking fix it. I'm just sitting over here being an asshole. That's fine. I feel like you're talking into your microphone through a megaphone. You're great just the way you are. Don't change a thing. I love you.
Are we ready?
For the Def Jam tour, let me hear you make some noise for Public Enemy.
But, so, yeah, I got lost on there. I'm not sure.
I have a question.
Oh, yes,
why did Spider-Man have a curly mullet?
It was the 90s. He looked like fucking Steve from Stranger Things.
Yeah, I can see I'm it. Not going to be able to unsee that anymore.
Not any of the Osbournes. Phil Urich is not Ozzy. It's not Harriet.
He was the Goblin Knight most recently.
There we go. Okay.
They ran out of subdivisions of goblins.
Goblins?
Yeah.
Strangely reminded me, and I'm going to just say it, it was like, you know, Ham Sandwich McFarlane. Really, all this is Punisher's hanging out on the street trying to take care of, you know, whatever he's trying to take care of. I don't know if he's getting groceries or what.
For him, these of course, melons aren't fresh.
Someone's going to die. Think, is it the Manhattan River, Mark? Is that what it is? Tell me yes.
There's the Hudson River and the East River. So it's
there's no such thing as the Manhattan River?
No.
I need to change my synopsis real quick.
Can we get an entire series dedicated 100 issues long of Peter Pan fights the Sentinels?
Parker? Yeah, that's it. I'm gonna shut up before I say any more stupid things.
Well, just like on the actual podcast, I'm going to mess up again here.
All right, take it easy.
You don't tell me to take it easy, bro.
He did it again.
Did you know in Orlando, the Halloween celebration has already begun? So don't wait. Treat yourself to an Orlando escape. From Halloween Horror Nights at Universal Orlando Resort, to Halloween Spooktacular at SeaWorld, to Mickey's Not-So-Scary Halloween Party at Walt Disney World, no one tricks and treats like Orlando, the Halloween vacation capital of the world. For official event schedules, discounted attraction tickets, and hotel deals, click to visitorlando.com. Did you know in Orlando, the Halloween celebration has already begun? So don't wait. Treat yourself to an Orlando escape. From Halloween Horror Nights at Universal Orlando Resort, to Halloween Spooktacular at SeaWorld, to Mickey's Not-So-Scary Halloween Party at Walt Disney World, no one tricks and treats like Orlando, the Halloween vacation capital of the world. For official event schedules, discounted attraction tickets, and hotel deals, click to visitorlando.com.